You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
John R. Talbot's new book, Contagion, lays out the current economic crisis in very clear terms, its causes, its consequences, and what it may mean to you. The concepts surrounding this crisis may be complex, but you don't need a PhD to understand what's happening or to make a plan to protect yourself. The book is published by John Wiley & Sons, and I'm very pleased that it brings John Talbot, who is been a Goldman Sachs banker and a visiting scholar at UCLA's business school, to this show today. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Leonard.
Is it possible for a layperson to come to grips with the complexity of all the causes of this global recession?
I'm not certain it's able to have a congressman come to grips with the complexities, but it's one of the most complex financial situations we've been in. I have email communications with some of the top Nobel Prize winning economists, and they haven't come to grips with it yet. But I think the fundamental underlying causes can be described in layman terms that people will understand it.
But did it become so complex that people stopped trying to understand what was happening and just went along with what seemed to be working? I was thinking about why someone as knowledgeable as Henry Kaufman would invest money with Bernie Madoff.
Yeah. I mean, Bob Rubin was the chairman of Citibank. Had tremendous stock options. He was involved. He was making his $15 million a year, and it happened on his watch. And he's one of the smartest people I knew at Goldman Sachs. So, you know, a lot of people missed it. I think your question gets to one of the root causes, which is what was a German bank doing buying California mortgages? I'm sure the person had never been to California, didn't understand how CDOs were structured. And where he gained comfort was this 30 or 40 year argument that you don't have to worry about the quality of the assets. You don't even have to worry about what price you pay. The market is so efficient, it will take care of all that. All you need to do is just diversify and hold a little bit of everything, and you'll be safe.
How many people understood mortgage derivatives or the Black-Scholes model of pricing before the crash?
Yeah, it's funny. Part of the problem here is the quant jocks took over Wall Street. So the mathematical geniuses and the computer jocks, they did understand the option pricing model, but unfortunately, they assumed that the real world operated like their models, and that's not necessarily true.
Well, what about you? Did you understand everything that was going on before you started researching books like this and your previous one, which was very prescient, The Coming Crash in the Housing Market?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I left Wall Street back in the 90s. But started writing seriously academic research papers and books. And my first book in 2003 was The Coming Crash in the Housing Market. I wasn't a housing expert at the time, but I was living in San Diego, and I had a good friend who taught high school. He was making $42,000 a year, and they lent him $305,000 to recapitalize his crummy little small two-bedroom condo. And I just knew something was wrong, and I started investigating. Again, you didn't have to understand Black-Scholes to see what the problem was. It was evident that too much money was being lent to people under crazy, crazy terms. And then you had to ask the question, why? And that was a more difficult question to answer. But I came to conclude that the bank's lending formulas were wrong, and they weren't holding these assets. They were shoving them upstream.
It was a bestseller, your last book. At the same time, nobody seemed to really be paying attention. The housing bubble continued.
Well, you know, I wished I could be more powerful in my influence. We sold a lot of books, and I still get emails from people who say they did get out. But, you know, when you sell 100,000 books, obviously it doesn't have the influence on 100 million American homeowners. So, but I think people are listening now.
Why did you call this book Contagion?
Well, the basis of this book is when this history is written, it will be true that this all started with American mortgages and American housing being overvalued, setting up a crash. But it's not going to end there. And the contagion is not only that it's going to extend to foreign countries of the world, but it's going to extend to all markets and beyond just credit markets. It's going to affect employment and high tech, and you know, the list goes on and on and on. I had trouble thinking of a good country to invest in. That's how interconnected the world is today.
Even though there are some countries, some developing nations that look like they are sure bets?
Well, they were 18 months ago, but the numbers are quite revealing. You know, China, people think it has a $7 trillion economy. Well, that's measured in purchasing power terms to equate what you can buy here versus there. when you look at it on a pure market-based exchange rate basis, they're really less than a $2 trillion economy, and almost half of that is exports. The other half is probably selling to people that are exporting. So guess what? Their exports are off who knows what percentage. Korea's off 45%, Taiwan's off 51%, China's slower to admit it. But, you know, these countries are really, really hurting because they're selling to Europe and the U.S. Europe and the U.S. are the consumption driving all of this emerging market development. So, no, China's stock market's off 75%. Brazil's off tremendously. Russia, I think, is at great risk of bankruptcy. So it's hitting worldwide.
And did this crisis start and will it end with Wall Street, or is Wall Street being given an unfair amount of the blame?
Well, you know, they're such a big, powerful engine in this that they deserve a great deal of the blame. But if you look down the food chain in the real estate business, we had real estate agents that you would hire as your agent when you went to buy a home, and they were advising you to pay more money, not less money, to buy the home because they wanted to be the winning real estate agent. They only got paid if you ended up buying the home. And so it was in their interest for you to overpay. And they went out and hired supposed independent appraisers. But there was no independence involved. They told the appraiser what price they needed the appraiser to come in to get the business. And if the appraiser couldn't get to that number, then he wasn't hired. So, you know, and then you had the worst offense, of course, was the mortgage brokers who, when you applied for a $1 million home with $100,000 of income, they simply erased the one, wrote in $200,000, and your application was approved. So, no, this entire system was not only fraudulent, but I believe criminal. And then it extended all the way up to the rating agencies, which were the worst offenders, followed quickly by the commercial banks and the investment banks. So it's hard to find someone without blame.
And government, because of deregulation and other things that have happened there.
Yeah, I look at government now as just the paid employee of big corporations in Wall Street. If you ask, what does government do? How did they regulate Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Why did they allow banks to leverage themselves up 30-1? The simple answer is they were being paid to, and they were being paid enormous amounts of money, over $100 million in contributions just from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And the hedge funds we know are the biggest contributors, the National Realtors Association in the top 10, the American Mortgage Bankers Association, the American Bankers Association, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley. These are all top 10 contributors to your Congress, and oh, by the way, right in the middle of this crisis.
My guest is John R. Talbot. His latest book, Contagion, The Financial Epidemic That's Sweeping the Global Economy and How to Protect Yourself from It. It's published by Wiley. But haven't there always been business cycles? Is this any different from the previous ones?
Well, you sound like Alan Greenspan, which I don't know if is a compliment anymore or not. But he tries to argue that this is just a 100-year flood, that this is just random events, and that things like this always happen in business. I've never believed that. I've never believed that we have to go through severe contractions and recessions and depressions. I believe what happens is we let business have a free rein because of their lobbying effects on Congress. They leverage up, our banking system leverages up, and then any small minor loan loss causes a freezing of credit and the banks pulling back in all of their lending. And when banks pull back on all their lending, what do we call it? We call it a recession. But it doesn't have to happen, and it certainly didn't have to happen here. I mean, if you look back at the record, in 99, they got rid of Glass-Steagall. They allowed the commercial banks to securitize assets and sell them all over the world. In 2001, they said they didn't need to regulate hedge funds and the derivatives market, especially the credit default swap market, which is a major component of this mess. And then in 2004, they said, yeah, go ahead, banks, leverage up 40-1. So, I mean, it was all pre-planned. This was not an accident.
Well, but how much of it is based on ideology, belief that the system corrects itself and that it is a perfect system?
Well, this is a philosophical question because there's no question Alan Greenspan is a true believer. You know, he cites Ayn Rand for a lot of his philosophy, which is kind of scary because Ayn Rand's a novelist writing fiction. But you have to understand, there might be greater powers to be. Who are the people that gave Alan Greenspan the job? I believe Alan Greenspan could pass a lie detector test that he really does believe all this free market stuff. But he was chosen by somebody, and I think the reason they chose him was not because they believe that free markets completely unregulated would create value. Rather, it would allow corporations to do whatever they wanted to, harm their workers, to pollute, to do whatever they needed to increase profits for their shareholders.
Let's go back to the housing crisis, which started this whole thing. You say that every crash is preceded by a boom. How big was the housing boom that preceded this crash, and how long had it gone on?
Well, by my calculation, and you can't look at nominal numbers, you have to adjust for inflation, it looks like housing prices started increasing in 1981, real home prices in the country. And that dovetailed with when Reagan came into office, stopped printing money, and interest rates started coming down. So it seems to make some intuitive sense. In 97, there was an explosion, and the growth became exponential, hyperbolic. And there was no explanation for that. And if you track back, we were in an internet bubble, but it was also the time period where the banks were creating crazy exotic mortgages like no amortization, ARMs, option pay, etc. So there's a very close correlation between the crazier mortgage terms and the prices paid. But to answer your question, in real terms, housing across the country probably went up 50 to 70% over that 20-year period. But on the coasts, in California, Florida, Las Vegas, Arizona, prices went up 400 and 500% in real terms. And yet underlying incomes never moved and underlying rents never moved. So it was completely unsustainable.
Well, how much of it was just simply belief by builders that this thing would never end? I know some people who live inland in California who live in an area where they can't give away houses.
Yeah. No, builders bought into
this. And this has been going on now for the last 5 or 6 years. I'm not talking about something that happened just because of this recent crisis.
Right. But builders in this, you know, people seem to gain confidence because builders were so confident. But builders are on the other side of this. Builders are not buyers of homes. They're sellers of homes. As a matter of fact, the reason they increased their activity so dramatically is because they saw that home prices were overvalued. And what they do is they arbitrage that opportunity by taking wood and nails and dirt and turning it into homes. So if you had that ability to turn dirt into homes, you'd expand your horizon and opportunities tremendously.
How do you look at the price of houses relative to income?
There shouldn't be a correlation.
In the old days, you if you were renting an apartment, it couldn't cost more a month than 1 week's pay.
Right, right.
That's no longer the case.
No, and if you buy a home in the old days, the same days prior to 1995, it used to be that banks would lend you about 2.5 to 3 times your combined income, which is really kind of generous given that the divorce rate, I think, in America is still pushing 50%. But at the peak in the 2006 year, that ratio had gone to 11 times combined income in San Diego, and it approached 7.5 to 8 times nationwide. So again, an indication that regardless of the beauty of the house, regardless of the number of baths and the size of the swimming pool, it was not going to be sustainable. People were not going to be able to continue to make their mortgage payments.
How did Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac get involved in this?
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, for how much I dislike them, really are starting to get blamed way too much for their involvement. There's still a lot of free marketers hanging on out there that are looking to blame government for all of this, and I don't think the case can be made. It turns out that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac did cause parts of the problem because they were the biggest lobbyists, they were leveraged over 100 to 1, and they had this implied guarantee from the government on all of their debt. We didn't know it was a real guarantee until Hank Paulson honored it to the Chinese and made them 100% whole. So I don't want to diminish their involvement, but I will tell you this. When the 2003 book came out, The Coming Crash, it got the back page book review of the Wall Street Journal, and within 2 months, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were shut down. They fired their CEOs, their CFOs. They each had to divest $200 billion of assets, and they froze their assets. So they basically sat out the worst period from 2003 to 2006, and their market share went down 14 points. They can't be blamed for this. This was all private enterprise seeking profits, and that's what caused the worst of this.
Well, if the cause of the crisis was paying too much for homes, doesn't the blame lay with the buyer?
Well, normally you'd think that, right?
I mean, nobody's forcing them to go into this much debt.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first rule of economics, right? Is why, and because of that, behavioral economists today say, oh, the buyers were irrational. Well, let me pose a question to you, and you tell me if this is rational or not. What if I gave you $1 million to buy a home, 100% of the financing, no money down, no fees, in California, and I told you that homes had increased 50 years in a row? And you knew that if home prices went up, you'd like to purchase the biggest home possible to get the biggest return because it's not your money. And, oh, by the way, you know that if prices go down, you hand me the keys and walk away. Now, I don't see any irrationality in that at all.
Well, who's being irrational then? Why would the banks take on more risk than they can handle?
Because the world changed. The world changed because the banks used to have to hold that asset. And when they held that asset on their books for 30 years, they had to be very careful with their credit decisions. But the world changed with securitization and the repeal of Glass-Steagall. The banks no longer held these assets on their books. They upstreamed them to pension funds, sovereign governments, world banks, etc. And so all the losses you're seeing at the commercial banks are really just the tip of the iceberg. It's just the stuff in inventory they had left behind before they could actively package it and sell it. The big losses here have not been admitted yet, and those are in sovereign governments and more specifically in pension funds.
My guest is John R. Talbot. His latest book, Contagion, The Financial Epidemic That's Sweeping the Global Economy and How to Protect Yourself from It, is published by Wiley. We'll continue right after this. Later in this hour, was Booker T. Washington something of an Uncle Tom, as many historians have suggested? Later, Alvin and Larry Ubell answer your questions on home repair. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with John R. Talbot, who is a former investment banker for Goldman Sachs, previously a visiting scholar at UCLA's Anderson School of Management, and for the last decade a writer who has written quite a few books, including Slave Wages, A Coming Crash in the Housing Market, Where America Went Wrong, and How to Regain Her Democratic Ideals, Sell Now, The End of the Housing Bubble, and Obamanomics. His most recent one is Contagion, The Financial Epidemic That's Sweeping the Global Economy and How to Protect Yourself from It, published by Wiley. So let's finish up with the housing crisis. How bad is it, and when is it likely to end?
Well, it's very bad, right? I mean, house prices nationwide are off 23% already. But as we said, the big increase during the boom was on the coast. So there are cities, as you described, these inner cities from Los Angeles and San Diego and San Francisco, that are off 50, 60, 70% already.
But mostly, it doesn't seem to have hit New York.
It hasn't hit New York yet. but I guarantee you it's coming. And it's really just started in the last 3 months. You're starting to see the softness. And the reason it hasn't hit Manhattan yet is the same reason it hasn't hit La Jolla yet or Del Mar in San Diego. And that is, it always hits poor and more middle-class neighborhoods first because they get defaulted and foreclosed first because they don't have other sources of income to keep paying their mortgage. But the wealthy in La Jolla, when they walk out of their $2 million home and they see every house on the street for sale for $1 million, I assure you they're not going to keep paying their mortgage payments.
But there was a lag between the housing crisis and the economic crisis. Why didn't it spark one immediately? Didn't the people who lost houses lose cash as well?
Well, this is completely different than any prior recession. Typically, what happens in a recession is a business segment suffers, they have layoffs, those people that are laid off default on their mortgages, and you have housing price declines. Here, because we let this crazy banking sector go so wild with aggressive banking terms and aggressive money lending, here the housing prices occurred first. So I would argue, even though this has been going on now for 18 months, the traditional recession is just starting now, which is now we're having layoffs. And now, guess what? Those people being laid off are going to contribute to further housing price declines.
So are people missing the point when they think that this is like the stock market crash of 1987 or the bursting of the internet bubble, the dot-com bubble in 2001?
Yeah, this is going to be much, much worse than any recession. And when you think of recessions, you always think of them sort of bouncing back. And the only question is it going to be 12 months till the market and the economy bounce back, or is it going to be 18 months? This is a dead cat. This is not bouncing anywhere. And the reason is because banks aren't going to be lending 10 times your income anymore to buy a house.
You say that Medicare and Social Security are liabilities of the government, even though they're holding surpluses.
Well, they're not holding the surpluses they should be holding, right?
Well, I mean, they have real surpluses, but we've been taking money away from
right.
them.
That's right. We've been spending it.
Aren't we supposed to just give it back at some point?
If we had it, but we invested it in treasuries and it got used for the general operations of the, running the country. No, there's no money there. I mean, the baby boomers are working now and we're supposed to be saving this big surplus to fund their retirement and their medical needs. The money's gone. And like this stimulus plan, we keep borrowing from our children to keep our current consumption high. But that game's over now. And the question is, where does it settle? I think the GDP settles significantly lower because we just can't keep borrowing.
We've talked about this as a global crisis. Did other countries also have real estate prices escalating the way they did here?
Yeah, it's funny, the ones that did. It was Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, the United Kingdom, and Spain were kind of the worst offenders. I lived in Ireland for a year, 3-4 years ago, and it was dramatic because the same ratio jumped out at me. They thought they had high-tech jobs. They were inside the European Union's borders, but really all they were doing were buying Taiwanese computers and repackaging them, sticking a label on them. They were making 30,000 euros a year, and the average home price in Dublin was 240,000. So again, you just divide those numbers and say this is completely unsustainable, and guess what? Ireland home prices are now off 35% on their way to being off 50%.
Now, I've covered some of this material before, and yet I'm still not sure if I totally understand the concept of a derivative and how Bear Stearns, when it went under, had $190 billion in external debt but $2 trillion in credit default swaps.
Well, I'm glad you don't understand it, right? Because it's not intuitive. It's not right. I mean, the whole idea of credit default swaps, the reason why the market was created 10 years ago, was to allow people that held company debt, that held Bear Stearns debt, to allow them to hedge that exposure to Bear Stearns going bankrupt. And so if there were $190 billion of debt outstanding, which is the right number for Bear Stearns, you would think at most there would be $190 billion of credit default swaps outstanding. The fact that there were $2 trillion of Bear Stearns credit default swaps outstanding tells you that that marketplace, that credit default swap marketplace, is not a hedging marketplace. It's a speculative casino. And it has grown from $145 billion 10 years ago to $65 trillion today. It's, I believe, one of the major contributing causes to all of this, because guess what? Nobody can go bankrupt without collapsing the credit default swap market. And so when no one can go bankrupt, you violate the first premise of capitalism.
Most school districts in this country rely on property taxes to support their educational programs. How will they be affected by this?
They're going to get killed. It's an entire chapter in the book. It's not just property taxes, although that's a huge component. They also rely on local sales taxes and local income taxes, and they're all collapsing. And what's worse, during a period where their revenue base is absolutely shrinking, what's happening on the expense side? They've got 55 and 58-year-old baby boomers with 20 and 25 years of service, firemen, policemen, et cetera, and they're going to retire early. They've had enough, and they're going to be very, very expensive retirement plans and very, very expensive medical plans.
Well, most of those people are assuming that they'll retire in the homes that they have bought. Is that going to be a problem as well?
I don't think so. I'm not a big supply and demand guy on homes. You know, people try to during the boom, the boom prices were justified saying we had this big immigration wave. Well, I know who the immigration wave is. It's poor Mexicans. They weren't buying million-dollar homes in California. And that's, as I said, where the greatest price appreciation was. So I'm just not a big believer. If you are a big believer in supply-demand of homes driving prices, you should be cautioned that there are a lot of elderly Americans who are going to be moving to nursing home facilities and critical care facilities in the future. They're going to free up a whole lot of homes. So I don't see the home building industry coming back quickly.
My guest is John R. Talbot. His latest book, Contagion, The Financial Epidemic That's Sweeping the Global Economy and How to Protect Yourself from It, is published by Wiley. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We've heard again and again that it's in the interest of Main Street to save Wall Street, is it?
It is. It absolutely is. But you have to define save properly. It doesn't mean taking taxpayer dollars and bailing out equity investors and debt investors in specific companies. The problem with the bailout scheme to date, and I think it's reflected in Geithner's comments yesterday, is they keep trying to give our taxpayer money to these companies that need to restructure. They need to tell the debt investors in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, for example, no, you don't get 100 cents back on your dollar. You've been earning a premium return for 100 years. You bet wrong. You bet that these were stable, long-operating companies, and they're not. They're bankrupt. You need to take a hit on your capital. And if you restructure these banks and you haircut the debt, if you bankrupt the equity holders, if you replace the managements, a basic premise, then at that point, yeah, the banks probably still need a couple of trillion dollars of capital. And at that point, I think the taxpayers would be willing to write a check to stabilize the financial system.
There was an article in the Times that pointed out that Timothy Geithner won the debate in the White House over how strict the terms would be. And he wanted a lot easier terms than other people in the Obama brain trust.
Yeah, I bet you today he's sorry he won the debate, that the stock market was off 400 points yesterday while he was testifying to Congress. But it was disturbing what his plan is, because
a little Bush, accountability, isn't it?
Well, the Bush plan was extremely disturbing because we were putting taxpayer money in without haircutting the debt investors. Well, Geithner's taken it one step worse. He's now saying, let's preserve the equity holders' investment. And, oh, by the way, let's keep all the bank management's jobs. So I just don't think somebody that's been part of the system can step outside of it and self-evaluate and see how dramatic the changes are that needed to be accomplished here.
You write about how the model of American meritocracy has been damaged by this. What's the best predictor of a child entering first grade as to his future educational and business success later in life?
The income of his parents, right? I mean, you don't need to know anything else for either a high school graduate or a first grader graduate. All you have to know is the income of his parents, and I can predict, you know, what his success in his life is going to be. And that violates everything we know about American meritocracy.
You've described the housing crash and the mortgage and banking crisis as a car wreck. And we just haul away the wrecked car and crush it and then use it for new steel. What do we do here?
Well, I describe it as a car wreck in slow motion, because as you see, the difference between a housing collapse and a stock market collapse is stock markets can adjust literally in 60 seconds. I mean, there are stocks that have moved 50 and 60% in less than a minute. Housing is just very, very slow to react. People are very, very slow to recognize that their home values might be less than what they paid for them. But as to the question of what we do, it's a very, very serious problem. You can't destroy an entire capitalist system and an entire global financial system by just making a minor error. There has to be some fundamental problems that we face in how we're organized as a capitalist society.
And you said earlier that lobbying plays a major role in this, and you believe that reforming the campaign finance system is a primary objective. How do you feel about Barack Obama's rejecting public funds during the last campaign?
Well, you know, the good news is he raised a lot of money. The good news, it came from individuals mostly. So he wasn't taking money from big corporations, big PACs, big lobbyists. He was the first one to use the power of the internet to get money from people. So if you've got a system where moneyed advertising drives it, I think he played the game about as cleanly as you can.
What do you think of his stimulus plan?
I've never been a big supporter of trillion-dollar stimulus plans. I think they sound to every – they're being pitched to everybody as if they're a silver bullet.
Well, John Maynard Keynes is considered one of the great economic heroes of the 20th century. Isn't this pretty much Keynesian economics?
This is Keynesian economics, and there's a huge debate going on right now between Paul Krugman and Eugene Fama, the Chicago School versus the Keynesians. Some of the Chicago School is arguing there's not going to be any effect. Some, like Gary Becker yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, are arguing there'll be some effect, but less than $1 trillion. And then you have Krugman, who believes there'll be a multiplier effect, that you'll get a 1.5 times increase in GDP.
Isn't part of the problem that the models we've been using don't always work?
I think that's it exactly. I mean, you ought to hear how strongly the economists on both sides of this argument swear they know what's happening. I don't think any of them know what's happening. I think when they answer a question, what they're telling you is what their models predict will happen, but it doesn't. The world's much more complicated than they understand. And I think they do a disservice. I think Larry Summers and I think Paul Krugman do us a disservice if they state their opinion so strongly as to not allow for the probability or the chance that they might be wrong.
Well, you're saying that the solutions proposed kind of finance more consumption with additional debt. In other words, you're saying that these solutions are just going to add to the current situation? Do exacerbate it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you've ever drinking alcohol at night, right, the hair of the dog is to do more of the same in the morning. You know, it stops the swelling of the brain against the skull. Well, this is the approach here, that what got us into this mess was we doubled the amount of borrowing in the country. The amount of borrowing in the country went from $25 trillion to $55 trillion. Banks doubled their leverage, corporations, our government doubled their debt, and consumers. So we had a four-legged stool with everybody borrowing more. And what did they do? They all consumed. They were all borrowing and consuming in a low interest rate environment. And so what's the proposed solution? More government borrowing, more spending, more consumption. I think it's because economists don't want GDP to decline. They're not going to be able to stop it. It needs to return to more sustainable levels.
But isn't this approach similar to what FDR instituted at the beginning of his term? And didn't it work? You stimulated the economy, gave people jobs. The dollar went further because people had more money to spend.
Yeah, I mean, this is the great debate, right, is whether it worked. If it had worked, we wouldn't call it the Great Depression. We call it the Great Depression because it literally went on until 1941 when we started World War II. So,
well, some people say that's because FDR then tried to balance the budget too soon.
Well, like I say, you'll hear opinions on both sides. But again, it's extreme thinking, but there's a lot of Chicago school professors who think FDR had it wrong, that if he had just allowed GDP to settle, allowed wages to settle, that the market would have taken off.
And then there are others who say that the Chicago school is the cause of many of these problems. Milton Friedman was the problem, not the solution.
Milton Friedman, you know, is to be credited for introducing capitalism to the world, to taking 240 million poor out of China and India. But we're not talking about capitalism anymore. We're talking about also that Milton Friedman was the number one libertarian, and he really honestly believed the only thing government should do is national defense. And it's kind of embarrassing that he didn't even know that his precious free market system depended on rules and regulations. You can't have a free market without protecting property rights, without preventing fraud, without honoring contracts, without a legal system and a justice system. And it's the basis of any free market anywhere in the world. As a matter of fact, if you look at the poor nations of the world, the ones that are doing better are the ones with better governments and better rule of law. And the ones that are struggling are in dictatorships and no rule of law.
Well, we're likely to have more regulation, but I'm getting the feeling from this conversation that you don't think this crisis is going to end anytime soon.
It's not going to end anytime soon because, as I said, the problem is absolutely fundamental to how we're organized, not only on Wall Street, but in Washington.
So will we see a different America as a result?
We're definitely going to see a different America. The question is, how long will it take us to get our act together? I think there has to be a revolutionary re-involvement of the American people in their government. I think their government representatives are bought and paid for, and I think they're going to continue to bail out their friends and give money to their friendly bankers until the American people become outraged enough to get re-involved in their government.
John R. Talbot's book, Contagion, The Financial Epidemic That's Sweeping the Global Economy and How to Protect Yourself from It, is published by Wiley. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Leonard. That was fun.
Up next, historian Robert J. Norell reevaluates the achievements of Booker T. Washington. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.